Sexual relationships today have many possible names. They can be hookups, they can be one-night stands, friends with benefits, and so on and so forth, which make relationships increasingly difficult to define, at least up until a certain stage. Negative relationships for me are the result of a hyper-connected modernity. And so these negative relationships have fuzzy, unclear, undefined, and contested purposes, as I gave you examples of. They have no clear frame of meaning. Their frame is constantly negotiated and contested by two people entering the relationship.
Sie ist eine Dolmetscherin moderner Beziehungen und erklärt uns, woran die Liebe in Zeiten des Kapitalismus krankt. Die weltbekannte Soziologin Eva Illus hat für uns am AHA-Festival die Frage beantwortet, warum sind wir in der Liebe so unsicher? Den Vortrag, den ihr gleich hört, hielt sie im Januar 2022 im Südpol in Luzern. Viel Spaß mit der Audioversion dieser Lecture.
The question I'm supposed to answer tonight is what is uncertainty, and I'm going to zigzag around it. I'm going to start by trying to define or at least provide some elements to think about what I think is certainty, but in the emotional realm. So that's often how I proceed when I think about a topic and I don't really know exactly how to define it, I go to its opposite. And I'm going to start like this. I'm going to start with an 1884 novel by Anthony Trollope, the English writer, which offers a powerful illustration of the ways in which in 19th century emotions were aligned with norms of matrimony. So this is the story of a young woman, Mary is her name. She's an orphan and she went to live with her uncle, who is an old man of 50. And his name is Mr. Whittlestaff. And Mr. Whittlestaff has never married. And Mary anticipates what she thinks and knows will be the question that he's going to pose to her. And so this is how the narrator tells us how she thinks about this. She told herself that he was personally full of good gifts. How different might it have been with her had some elderly men wanted her, such as she had already seen in the world? How much was there in this man, that is Mr. Whittlestaff, that she knew that she could learn to love? And he was one of whom she need in no ways be ashamed. He was a gentleman, pleasant to look at. He was sweet in manner, comely and clean in appearance. Would not the world say of her that she was lucky should it come to pass that she should become Mrs. Whittlestaff? After 1 hour's deliberation, she thought that she would marry Mr. Whittlestaff. Now notice, in the story, these reflections are not formulated as a response to a question that he has posed her. Rather, she knows that he's going to propose, even though nothing has been said between them. Her decision to such presumed proposal in question is also very clear, and I would say very short. In a matter of 1 hour, Mary has settled with herself her matrimonial future by invoking and rehearsing mentally the set of arguments and reasons for accepting Mr. Whittlestaff. And these arguments, note also that it's quite interesting, these arguments have much to do with what she knows or imagines the world would say should she become his wife. That is, she sees in him the same virtues that others see in him, thus suggesting actually an overlap between her private judgment and collective judgment. And so I would say that her evaluation of Mr. Whittlestaff are based on known social scripts of the good man. They're based on norms of matrimony. They're based on conventions on the role, on the proper role of a woman. And I would say also that her affection, she has affection for him, but this affection is grounded in common and known standards. It doesn't have that kind of highly subjective and subjectivist character that contemporary affections that we may have for other people has. So you see here in this short example how her feelings and her decision incorporate and mix together sentiments, economic advantage of a marriage, and the social expectation of a woman in her situation, and the standards to evaluate characters. Feelings and norms form a single matrix that is closely intertwined. Perhaps Emil Durkheim was the first to have grasped, at least sociologically, what the collapse of such emotional, normative, and institutional order was about. Infrequently noticed by sociologists is the extent to which Durkheim's very famous notion of anomia, I don't know how you say it in English, anomia, I think, in his much famed study of suicide, referred also to sexual and matrimonial desire. I mean, you know, Durkheim actually almost founded sociology by a study, by showing that people committed suicide, people who were members of certain groups, men, single men, Protestant, were more likely than women, married women, and Jewish, for example. And that was really a founding moment of sociology. But sociologists have not noticed enough that what Durkheim called anomia, that is the fact that an individual is not connected enough to his group, which provokes him to commit suicide, presumably, also described a new form of desire. I quote Durkheim in his famous study, The Suicide. He says, though the married man's enjoyment is restricted, it is assured of this, and this certainty forms his mental foundation. And then he goes on and he says, the lot of the unmarried man is different, as he has the right to form attachment wherever inclination leads him. He aspires to everything and is satisfied with nothing. This morbid desire for the infinite, which everywhere accompanies anomy, may as readily assail this as any other part of his consciousness. When one is no longer checked, one becomes unable to check one's self. Beyond experienced pleasures, one senses and desires others. If one happens to have exhausted the range of what is possible, one dreams of the impossible. One thirsts for the non-existent. So, and he says, how can the feelings not be exacerbated by such unending pursuit? The humdrum existence of the bachelor suffices. New hopes constantly awake, only to be deceived, leaving a trail of weariness and disillusionment behind them. How can desire then become fixed, being uncertain that it can retain what it attracts? For the anomie is twofold, and this is critical. He says, for the anomie is twofold. Just as the person makes no definitive gift of himself, he has no definitive title to nothing. The uncertainty of the future plus his own indeterminateness therefore condemn him to constant change. The result of it all is a state of disturbance, agitation, and discontent, which inevitably increases the possibilities of suicide. So Durkheim offers here, I think, really an extraordinary program for what we may call a sociology of emotional decision making and uncertainty. Because what he's saying is that some desires translate into direct decision making. This is marriage. This is the married man. And he's building a type, if you want, of the unmarried man who goes from one adventure to another, to another, to another. And this man cannot bring himself to make a decision. The single man's desire is anomic because it undermines the capacity to will an object with a definite purpose. Anomic desire, then, for Durkheim, is not depressive. It's not apathetic. It is, on the contrary, I would say, hyperactive, restless, in perpetual quest of something. It is a desire that cannot enter marriage because it cannot create the psychic conditions to want a single object. It is a desire that properly lacks an object and which, in lacking an object, that is insatiable, it is diffuse, it has many objects at once. And so it creates a particular form of action, which I would say is at one at the same time in perpetual motion, lacks an overarching purpose, and is almost structurally uncertain. That is, it cannot define what it's about, its aboutness, in other words. Uncertainty, accumulation, motion, inability to imagine the future, all of these constitute the essence of what Durkheim views as anomic desire, unable to appropriate social norms and to identify with institutions. Sexual anomie is thus many things at once. It is an excess of desire. It is a form of desire that originates in the self itself, unmoored, unattached to social norms. It is, if you want, it derives from a subjectivity that takes itself as its own center and becomes therefore diffuse, vague, ambivalent, and purposeless, because such subjectivity is unable to propel the subject toward or forward along a narrative and a normative and emotional path. And so if I wanted to, so this is why I talked about a zigzag. I started with something that looks to me like an emotional structure that has a great deal of certainty. I moved to something that seems to me like uncertainty, or at least a sociology of laying the ground of what would be a sociology of uncertainty. And now I want to ask myself in a much more precise fashion, what is certainty? What I want to say is that I think that what Durkheim is doing in the example I gave you is that he's trying to articulate two grammars of social bond and of emotional desire, one which is structured by certainty and one which is structured by uncertainty. And the one that is structured by certainty is the one in which desire is not absent, but rather desire is organized through the fusion of economic interests, norms, matrimony, and gender roles. And so this is what I want to understand now. I want to understand uncertainty through certainty, and I want to understand better what is certainty. And the way I want to understand certainty is to understand it as the result of sociological processes. And I went back to the mechanism of courtship, what we call courtship. And I think that we have not paid enough attention to the disappearance of courtship from modern relationships, contemporary sexual and romantic relationships. And so going back to traditional courtship, what I want to do is draw, if you want, a kind of prototype of what that traditional courtship was. And I want to say that it was characterized by six forms of certainty. And when I say six forms of certainty, I speak of certainty not only as a psychic attribute, not only as an attribute of the psyche, but also and mostly as an attribute of social interactions. And if you want, I would say this is maybe my small contribution to this sociology of certainty or uncertainty, namely to say that when we feel certain, when we are certain in an interaction, it's not because we have self-confidence, but also because relationships are structured in such a way. This is what I would like to show now. Normative certainty. It pertains to the relative clarity of norms and values in an interaction. The easier it is to identify a norm in an interaction, the more forceful the interaction is, the norm is, and the more predictable the interaction is. It's very easy. I mean, it's much more predictable that you will go out fully clad than to predict whether you're going to buy flowers on your third date to a man or a woman. And the protection of women's virginity remained one of the most fundamental norms at the center of traditional courtship until well into the 20th century, even though it was not, of course, always respected at all. But women had to protect their sexual purity, and men were held actually actively responsible for deviations from sexual conduct. So normative certainty is one element. Two is what I call existential certainty. Normative certainty yields existential certainty, that is the perceived fit between one's subjective and objective social experience. Existential certainty enables me to answer very easily the question of who am I in this situation and who is the other to me. As a result, it is very easy also to respond to the question, what do I owe this person in this interaction? Gender divisions and gender distinctions were crucial aspect of the system of predictability in a courtship. Courtship was geared to an object, that is a woman. It was started by a man, and the woman had to decide to reciprocate an emotion or an action that was initiated by a man. And in that respect, it was structured by very clear gender roles. As Jane Austen put it in the mouth of Henry Tilney in Northanger Abbey, man has the advantage of choice, women only the power of refusal. Existential certainty, therefore, derived from what gender distinctions and gender roles and gender inequalities, of course, as well, which gave each one a very strong sense of place in an interaction. Three, ontological certainty. The third mechanism which created certainty in courtship lied in what I call the objectivation of feelings through the material world of tokens and gifts. So what I mean by this is that in traditional courtship, you exchanged gifts and tokens of various value because these gifts and tokens marked, so to speak, outside the two people, in an objective world, their intentions. If you marked the capacity to seal in the world, in the objective world, what two people told each other. Historian John Gillis remarked, the intention of the giver of a gift had much to do with whether the gift had binding powers. Once you made a gift, that gift had a kind of life of its own. It had binding powers. almost outside the will of the two people. And so objects played a very important role in objectifying relations, that is, in marking their progression and pacing them and giving the people a sense that they knew what the other person was feeling and having a proof, a tangible proof of the intention of the other person. There was, for example, a custom in Britain of breaking a 3-penny coin and keeping each side of the penny coin as a sign of the other's commitment. Add to this the fact that traditional courtship was very much marked by witnesses, outside witnesses. That is, before you got married, you brought people in to witness your courtship and to witness the intention of one person to marry you, which means that if somebody defaulted after there had been witnesses, it was actually something that you could sue for and definitely reclaim the gifts that you had given, for example, if you did not proceed with a marriage. So there was an objectified system of gift exchange and witnesses which established the relationship performatively rather than through subjective introspection, rather than through people asking themselves constantly, what are they feeling? These things marked the feelings in the world. Four, evaluative evaluative certainty is the capacity to gather reliable information about others and to know how to evaluate them according to established standards and criteria of evaluation. Now, I'm not saying that people knew better than we do how to evaluate each other. That's not the point. The point is that they had the criteria. And not only did they have criteria, as I gave you the example of Mary Laurie in the novel of Trollope, but also they were able to mobilize a network of kin and people who actually helped them decide whether this person was appropriate or not. This is how it was done. So, and add to this the fact that most people knew quite well the person they married from, because they were in the same village, or knew that person by reputation. That is, there was really an rather elaborate information gathering, which made evaluation into a collective act, with reputation playing an important role. Five, procedural certainty. Procedural certainty pertains to the rules with which one is able to carry forward an intention and in an interaction. So what I mean by this is that you know what is the sequence of things. You know you start at this point, and if you started here, you did this, then you know that this is the second thing you should do, and then the third. For example, in middle-class homes in the 19th century, there was a practice of calling on a woman. There was a protocol whereby a suitor would submit his desire to court a woman, and he would present himself. He would wait for the parents to agree, and then he would subsequently be admitted, and then the courtship in middle-class homes would follow certain procedures. So that means that there were rules and procedures which made the courtship have a kind of narrative structure. Courtship was, in fact, the experience of going through several stages or sequences, and it had this deep, narrative sense of progression. You moved step by step. And finally, emotional certainty. Emotional certainty pertains to the fact that actors act as if they knew, or at least expressed, the nature and intensity of their own emotions. And emotional certainty was often secured, actually, through a very striking characteristics of traditional courtship, which is that very often the man declares his love at the beginning of the courtship, and that in fact it is this declaration that starts the courtship. Calvin Lindley Roan courted an African-American school teacher in Texas. She was named Lucia. And his courtship took the form which many courtships took, in starting as the confession of an emotion or a revelation. This was a standard trope of how he started a courtship. On May 1886, Calvin wrote to Lucia a letter which started a 19 months courtship, and after which they got married. This is the first letter he writes, and he starts like this. The letter starts like this: "Do you ever think of me? Miss Lucia, it is unnecessary to say, I love you with all my heart." This is how it starts. And so, in many 19th century courtship, love was declared at the outset and was, in fact, the starting point of the interaction, which is why quite often the women in middle class in middle classes, the woman was in the position to decide whether or not to reciprocate. And so, if I would even say that quite often, emotional certainty was the condition under which a woman agreed to be courted by a man. She needed to know ahead of time that this is what he wanted. And so, what I have done so far is to describe and to kind of decompose the mechanism of certainty in many different components. And that enables me to say that these various dimensions of certainty derived from a sociological characteristic of courtship, namely that it actually had the structure of ritual. And interestingly enough, ritual was also a key concept in Durkheim's sociology. And actually, I think, although I'm not sure that Durkheim formulated it like this, but I think for Durkheim, ritual was the response to anomie. A ritual is the conceptual response to anomie, because rituals for Durkheim kind of create a dynamic field of energy that bind actor together through the enactment of rules. When people engage together in rituals, they don't introspect. They don't look at themselves. What they do is that they enact rules that they did not make up. They enact shared rules, and they participate together into a hot symbolic reality. And so rituals, like norms, actually define the intensity, the boundaries, and the object of emotions. And this is because, and this is a fascinating characteristic of ritual, for Durkheim, rituals reduce uncertainty and ambiguity. As Joel Robbins, an anthropologist, put it, rituals bring, I quote him, clarity, certainty, trustworthiness, and orthodoxy on the information it conveys. Rituals bring people together through predictable and shared rules, which actually, contrary to, I think, a cliché image we have of rituals, which actually, for Durkheim at least, intensifies and sharpens emotions, because it reduces self-awareness and increases the capacity to believe in the reality of the interaction we are in. And I think this is a fascinating anthropological insight about rituals. That is, non-ritualized interactions make you doubt much more their reality, precisely because they invite you to engage into self-introspection and self-awareness. This is what I think we can draw from Durkheim. So because ritual is a structured behavior, it directs attention to the object of the interaction rather than to the inner self. And that's why Douglas Marshall, another anthropologist, suggests that actors who engage in rituals experience, and I find this insight totally fascinating, he says, people who engage in rituals experience their own will. When attention is focused on an external object, the rule, the norm, whatever. It is the emotional relation to the object that occupies the center of consciousness. Inversely, introspection makes the self more focused on its emotions and it makes it more uncertain because it lacks those well-known procedural paths that come with ritual. So, to be clear, this form of certainty that I've described cannot be separated from religious patriarchy, gender inequalities, and the equation of sex with sinfulness. It was, in fact, directly produced by them. And I think this moral and cultural frame became contested and completely transformed in the aftermath of the vast cultural and social changes after the 1960s, what is commonly referred to as the sexual revolution. And now I want to give you two vignettes of what I mean when I speak about uncertainty, the kind of uncertainty we're experiencing right now. Now, this is a video that was posted on the website of the American magazine called The New Yorker. It's a comic exchange that takes place between five women. And as often is the case with comic exchanges, they actually pack a lot of information. Caricatures also do the same. They pack a lot of well-known information. Otherwise, you would not laugh. And so the first woman, "Ladies, thank you for being here today. We have a vital situation on our hands, and I appreciate your judgment, expertise, and discretion. I'll brief you quickly. I first met Kevin Harper 1 week ago at my weird friend's birthday drink. We talked briefly. He did not ask for my number. 3 days later, he Facebooked friend requested me and asked me to get a drink later that week. When I show up, he's there with his friends. One of them is a girl. She's prettier than me, but not by much. His friends leave. We have another drink. Just the two of us. We do not kiss. The question that faces us today is, was it a date or what?" So, young woman too, "Did he invite you back to his place or you?" "No, but only because he's unemployed and living with his aunt right now." Woman three, "Did you touch each other at all?" "His hands grazed my boob during drink three, but it could have been an accident." Woman four, "Was the vibe flirty?" "I think so." Woman five, "Did he buy you drinks? Did he pay?" "No, but that might be just because he's poor." Woman one or two, "Did he mention any other girl?" "No." "Is he gay?" "No, I found evidence of at least two prior ex-girlfriends on his Facebook and Instagram feeds." Woman three, "I don't know, girls, no kiss, not a good indicator." Woman four, "But that doesn't mean anything, he could have been just nervous." Woman five, "No way, this is might wise man all over again, 3 dates, no kiss, we cannot have a repeat of that." Have you established contact yet this morning? "Yeah, I texted him. It was fun last night. Winky face." He wrote back, "Yeah." Emoji, "No." He texts her while she's with her friends. He says, "Hey, can you not tell anyone about last night? Don't want my GF, girlfriend, to find out. Lol." He does not want his girlfriend to find out. Hey, that means it was a date. So this is humorous only because I think it describes a prototypical situation, which all of us have no difficulties, I think, understanding. It's highly resonant with experiences of contemporary women, contemporary interactions. The female friends mobilized engage with her in a highly elaborate, I would say, hermeneutic exercise. I'm sure many women here will identify and will know what this is about, highly elaborate hermeneutic exercises in order to decipher and encounter whose frame whose frame has no longer a clear meaning. The meaning of that interaction has collapsed. It's not clear anymore what means what. This is what this interaction means. I think this is one very important element to take away from this. And then let me give you a second anecdote taken from a novel called The Big Love. It's a chick lit. It's called chick lit literature. These are novels for women about relationships. And so Allison has a relationship with her boss, or had a relationship with her boss. By the way, the novel doesn't think it's a problem at all. It was written a while back. And so she enters his office, Henry, and she makes the following inquiry. She says, "I was wondering if we could talk about our relationship." "Relationship? What relationship?" Henry said, "Busy." "You know, I said this." Henry looked up from his papers. "What?" "What?" I said. "Well, I just didn't know we were involved in a relationship," said Henry. "Well, what would you call it?" "I don't know. I hadn't thought about it. I didn't know it needed a name." "We slept together 4 times, I said. "Huh. Okay, fine," I said. "I have my answer." I headed for the door. "Huh? And what answer is that?" said Henry. "This is just a fuck, which is perfectly fine. I just wanted to know." "I wouldn't call it that," Henry said. "Then what would you call it?" "Well, it's a bit of fun. It's somewhere between just a fuck and a relationship." End of quote. So you see, this dialogue is about trying to find a name for a relationship. It is a relationship that is located between and betwixt casual sex and a relationship in which the future is plausible. And this relationship does not have one of the central characteristics of relationships, which is what phenomenologists call their aboutness. Aboutness is a central feature of relationships. You almost always know what a relationship is about whether you go to buy your bread, whether you are interacting with your neighbor, whether you're talking to your father. There is an aboutness to relationship which is central to our social interactions. These examples I gave you, in this example, the relationship lacks an aboutness. We do not know the woman does not know what it's about. She does not have the overall frame of meaning to define that relationship. The man does not know his own intentions, and he's therefore unable to label the interaction. And it is the very multiplication of names of casual relationships. You know, she said, "Well, maybe it's this, maybe it's that." And sexual relationships today have many possible names. They can be hookups, they can be one-night stands, friends with benefits, and so on and so forth, which make relationships increasingly difficult to define, at least up until a certain stage. That is, the entire process of negotiating what the relationship is about is precisely the stage that has become plagued, I would say, and structured by a fundamental uncertainty that is a great difficulty to know which relationship you are engaged in. German sociologist Niklas Luhmann made certainty, and thereby uncertainty, into a central feature of social interactions. In his view, the reduction of complexity and uncertainty are fundamental components of social processes. Love, for him, along with truth, money, or power, is what he calls a medium of communication. It helps create expectations, select one decision among many, connect motivation to action, and create certainty and predictability in relationships. It creates roles. And these roles create also expected outcomes. To use an example that Luhmann's use, a wife will not be rejected if she asks her husband, "Why are you so late today?" So her role of wife entitles her, so to speak, to ask the question. So predictability for him is a fundamental dimension of social interaction to be found, I think, in especially in rituals. When interactions are ritualized, and by the way, Luhmann was not interested in rituals. As far as I know, he did not write about rituals. But I suggest that when interactions are ritualized, they precisely are able to generate certainty about what the relationship is and what one's position in a relationship is and what the rules of conduct in such relationship should be. So certainty can be described as referring to a person's ability to describe, predict, and explain behavior within social situations. This is exactly what those five women that I quoted to you before are unable to do. They are unable to say what this is about and how she should behave. Conversely, we can also define uncertainty as unclear, ambiguous, contradictory cognitive constructions which cause, and all of these go along with uncertainty. So, I have an elaborate explanation for this, but I'm not going to enter into the reasons why we have actually entered an era of uncertainty. It has, among other things, it has to do with profound transformations of sexuality that have to do with the separation of sexuality from matrimony and even from emotions. And so you have now three, I would say, to use an expression from a French sociologist, you have really three regimes of action that are totally separate from each other: the sexual, the emotional, and the matrimonial. And so this is what enables me, in fact, to formulate the notion of negative relationship, which I have formulated by referring to philosophy. Negative relationships for me are the result of a hyper-connected modernity. They're not, when I say negative relationships, I don't mean something that comes from negative emotions, and I don't mean loneliness. It's not at all what I mean. What I mean by a negative bond is that these are relationships in which there are two characteristics. One is that people do not know anymore what they want. This I take from Sartre's notion of indeterminateness. And you may recall that Durkheim himself spoke about the single man as having indeterminate desire, that is a desire that has no real object. And so I really elaborated this idea to show how really what we call sexual and romantic desire has changed to become indeterminate, using Sartre's terminology. And the second meaning of negative bond, which I use also, comes from Heidegger. And to remind you, for Heidegger, an unproblematic relationship is one where you do not ask yourself questions. And Heidegger uses the famous metaphor of a hammer. He says, "I am hammering, being barely aware of the hammer, and my project of hammering this piece, I'm barely aware of the hammer and of my project of hammering this piece of wood." But let's imagine that something breaks. The hammer breaks, or the nail breaks, or the wood breaks, and I suddenly pay attention to what I do. And I look at myself now, what I do, in a new way. And suddenly I become uncertain about what to do. So this is the second sense of negative for me. Negative is not, so the first meaning was a relationship or desire in which I do not know what I want. And the second meaning is something breaks. I don't know what to do. something does not go the way it should. And so because of that, I now adopt this kind of reflexive attitude toward the relation, And then, so for Heidegger, what had been ready to hand flips into being present at hand. What was unproblematic becomes problematic. Where I knew the rules, now suddenly I ask myself, what are the rules? And so this for me is really a new modality of social relationships, which point to the indeterminateness of desire. They reveal that something is not quite working as it should. And so these negative relationships have fuzzy, unclear, undefined, and contested purposes, as I gave you examples of. They have no clear frame of meaning. Their meaning, their frame is constantly negotiated and contested by two people entering the relationship. And so I think that in the realm of love and sexuality, we have really moved from a world in which culture described the world thickly in with moral narratives, with moral symbols. It prescribed behavior through hot meanings, through do's and don'ts, with well laid out plans of actions, to a modality of culture in which autonomy and freedom produce relatively weakly scripted fuzzy rules of interactions with unpredictable outcomes, and in which these interactions, the sexual ones, have become relatively normless and up for grabs. So we have a shift from thick normativity to very thin normativity. And this is what I call negative bonds, bonds that are chaotic, that have multiple definitions and purposes, that are undeterminate, and that have become the site for uncertainty. Thank you.
Danke, dass du diese Podcast-Episode gehört hast. Ich hoffe, sie hat dir gefallen und du konntest etwas Neues erfahren und lernen. Und wenn du schon mal da bist, lass uns doch eine Bewertung oder ein paar Sternchen da. Das würde uns sehr helfen. Und wenn du mehr Vorträge vom AHA-Festival hören willst, abonniere diesen Podcast und folge uns auf Instagram und Facebook. Auch über Feedback freuen wir uns sehr. Schreib uns eine Mail an am@aha-festival.ch. AHA, ein Podcast für Wissen, ist eine Zusammenarbeit von Christoph Fellmann und mir, Anna Matijasiewicz. Mitproduziert und komponiert hat Nikola Miloš Mišić.